Due to the explicit sexual nature of the following National Lampoon Radio Hour, it is featured as adult entertainment and not recommended for children's ears without parental supervision. Tonight's show will begin after this brief commercial word.
Good evening, this is John Belushi, and this is the National Lampoon Radio Hour.
Magnolia Pictures, a Fourth Row Films production. History Films presents in association with Sky, Passion Pictures, and Diamond Docs.
Hi, Dad!
Hello there, son. How was school today?
Okay. Hey, I heard a really neat joke at recess. You want to hear it?
Why, certainly, son. Go ahead.
Okay, well, you see, there was this priest and this minister and this, rabbi, yeah. And they were in this
Hold
car
it right there, son. Around this house, we don't make jokes about religion, do we?
Aw, but gee, Dad, it's a really cute joke.
Don't aw-gee me, son. You start off with cute jokes about religion, and you end up with atheistic trash like this December issue of the National Lampoon. It makes fun of saints and prayers and money and all that's sacred. This issue of the National Lampoon is foul and repulsive, and this is where your cute little jokes will lead you, son.
Okay, Dad, I'm sorry.
That's all right, son. You're forgiven. Oh, and son.
Yes, Dad?
You'll be sleeping with your mother tonight. It's my turn with your sister.
Front covers of National Lampoon magazines from the 1970s cost 85 cents, showing Nixon as Pinocchio, Ford and Carter wrestling under the headline Is Democracy Fixed? How to Talk Dirty in Esperanto.
City, strung out on lasers and slash back blazers and ate all your razors while pulling the weight.
Foreigners around the world, the Irish, French, Italians, Australians. Nixon nominated for Nobel War Prize.
I have this sense of humor that sort of didn't exist where I grew up. After reading that first National Lampoon, I went, wow, that's what I've been trying to say.
National Lampoon, it just meant a lot to me as a kid because it was what I wanted to do. It woke me up to the idea that this was a job.
Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
And then you get all these generations afterwards of people like me who are just trying to be those guys.
It was sharp, crystal clear, and above all, funny.
It just blew the whole shit house up.
The National Lampoon was defining part of the zeitgeist.
Here was this totally outrageous voice that was screaming, here I come.
Kevin Bacon. Go!
Breasts. I would try to seek out the magazine on the off chance that there would be some breasts.
Photographs and cartoons of breasts.
The humor was a little bit above my pay grade.
The Lampoons are very intellectual. Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller could have been part of National Lampoon.
We were taking on the idiocy of our own generation.
You know, overthrowing the ageist, racist, sexist, corporate pig monster is a full-time job.
They always had the best parties, the best drugs, the smartest people.
We could sell out more. And the moment we do sell out, totally, we'll be dead.
Title, National Lampoon, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead. Produced and directed by Douglas Tirola. John Landis, film director.
There's a time in everyone's life, and it's really between 17 and 22. When you talk to people in their middle age, they always talk about their high school or their college experience as the quote-unquote best years of their lives. And I'm thinking, well, why? And ultimately, it's because when you're 17, 18, you were expected to function as an adult, but you're a baby. Have you ever gone to a college campus? Those kids are babies, but they're adults. So there's this wonderful freedom, sense of adventure. We can do anything we want. We're college students. And that's really how the whole thing started.
Harvard University.
Fight fiercely, Harvard. Fight, fight, fight. Impress them with our prowess. Do.
What was it originally? The Harvard Lampoon, right? Well, anybody that mentioned Harvard, I just went, fuck you.
The Harvard Lampoon is one of those famous things that nobody has ever seen a copy of.
Fight, fight, fight.
Harvard Lampoon is America's oldest humor magazine, started at Harvard in 1876.
John Updike was an editor and George Plimpton was an editor.
Well, that's about it, you know. Two famous writers in 125 years. And we also had Fred Gwynn, the guy who played Herman Munster. It goes off the table after that.
Fight, fight, fight.
Harvard Lampoon was just this extracurricular activity and was something you did before you went into the family law firm or became a banker.
Doug Kenny and Henry Beard were in the class after I left Harvard. They were both incredibly brilliant and incredibly funny and incredibly good friends, but they weren't the same at all.
A cover titled Nancy Reagan's Guide to Dating Do's and Don'ts.
Doug Kenny was really the heart and soul of the Lampoon.
Doug was the sort of complete social opposite of Henry. For one thing, he did not come from an upper crust family.
Doug's father was the tennis pro at a golf club in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. Have you ever seen Caddyshack? That's Doug.
You take drugs, Danny?
Every day.
Good.
The very first time I met Doug, he was talking like William Makepeace Thackeray. I mean, he was actually improvising his prose, right? And it was Thackeray, it wasn't Dickens. And about 30, 45 seconds after that, he was demonstrating that he could put his entire fist in his mouth. So this was Doug, you know?
Doug was a performer. Doug wanted to be a star. And he was a smart, funny, complicated person who could write. Now that's rare.
An article by Doug Kennedy titled First Blowjob. Another, Practical Jokes for the Rich.
Henry was probably the smartest man I ever met. He could have been a nuclear physicist, he could have been a Supreme Court judge, he could have been anything.
I remember the first time Henry met my first wife. Afterwards, she said, I've met Holden Caulfield.
My father had graduated from Yale, and as a bit of youthful rebellion, I decided to go to Harvard.
Henry is about as private a person as you'll ever find. He was mysterious and elusive.
The two of them together were an absolutely amazing team. When I was at Harvard, we got a call one day from Betsy Talbot Blackwell, who was the editor-in-chief of Mademoiselle magazine. She had seen a parody issue that the Harvard Lampoon had put out, and Betsy said, you know, maybe I should ask these guys to do a parody of us, and we'll publish it in our own magazine. She offered us $7,000, which seemed like nothing even then, but what she also offered was a free subscription ad. We could do anything we wanted as long as we put the clothes in and as long as we showed the models, which of course led to a lot of good times. And as a result of that parody issue, we got tens of thousands of subscriptions right away. She gave us a national audience. The discovery was that rather than having to depend on Mademoiselle to make our magazines go national, the Harvard Lampoon could actually publish national magazines itself.
They did Time magazine, and they did Sports Illustrated, and they did Life magazine.
Doug Kenny and I decided to do a parody of Lord of the Rings. We sent a letter to Tolkien, who, honest to God, sent a letter back saying, yeah, go right ahead, it's a silly book.
I like the Playboy parody that they did where the centerfold girl was more tan around her bottom and top. She had reversed tan lines.
Playboy was a big hit nationally, and Doug and Henry realized that maybe there was some way that the National Lampoon could exist.
Don't touch that dial. The National Lampoon will be right back after this insincere commercial message written by some cynical Nazi solely for the purpose of ripping off your parents' money.
I think if you take yourself back to when you were in your 20s, all possibilities appear open to anybody. You know, you could go after anything at any time.
Doug and Henry had gone to New York in hopes of doing a 50-50 deal with some publishing group who would put up the money.
See, we met with some guys from Time and Life. I can't tell you how off-putting they were. Just saying, oh, you guys, you don't understand anything. You don't have a chance. You're toast. You're just not going anywhere. Doug Kenny was not very happy about that and said, you people are the kind of people who commute back and forth from Westport, Connecticut in a station wagon. We have nothing to do with you. I thought, holy God, but he was right. And that's how we ran into 21st Century Communications and Matty Simmons.
Doug Kenny, Henry Beard, and Rob Hoffman, three Harvard Lampoon editors, came into my office, and I was immediately impressed.
Matty Simmons.
Matty belonged to another generation. Very much New York, very much old school publishing.
This guy inventing the Diners Club card, which was the first credit card.
I think he wished he was in the Rat Pack. He sort of always had those bedroom eyes. You'd be talking to him about something serious, and he'd take a phone call and say, oh, yeah, darling, baby, I love you so much, I love you. Yeah, broccoli for dinner's fine. Yeah, thank you, goodbye.
He was very full of himself, knew the business inside out. Distribution in those days was, you know, there were some criminal elements. Matty wasn't one of them, but he had to deal with people like that.
Magazines in the late 60s were thought to take about 5 years before they got into the black. Rob intuited that this would either work or it wouldn't. So he made a bet when he negotiated the deal. He did a forced buyout after 5 years. It was kind of a gutsy move.
They owned 25%, I owned 75%. And part of the deal was after 5 years, I would buy them out. If this magazine is successful, I might owe these guys $5-6 million. But I made the deal. And we started National Lampoon.
Their first hire was Michael O'Donoghue, and Michael O'Donoghue was not Harvard. Michael O'Donoghue was Buffalo.
Boy, was he an angry bunny. He probably, as much as anyone, gave the Lampoon its tone. We're doing this in place of hitting you in the face.
He had this recipe box, you know, the ones that ladies have with the recipes in them. Oh, well, baked beans. But his recipe box was full of things like battling buses of World War II. He just had hundreds of these things.
He would take any chance, even though we were perfectly happy to do tasteful things. He pushed the bounds even further.
Doug did the dirty stuff, Henry did the brainy stuff, and O'Donoghue did the outrageous stuff, the really transgressive stuff.
Children's letters to the Gestapo. Dear Heinrich Himmler, how do you get all those people into your oven? We can hardly get a pork roast into ours. A cartoon of Dracula, Queen of Darkness, written by Tony Hendra.
Tony Hendra was a British comic. He's part of a comedy team called Ollett and Hendra.
He and his partner Nick Ollett used to be on the Merv Griffin Show.
When you hear the buzz, it will be the correct time. It is now the correct time.
Writing for television was like firing on one cylinder. Working at the Lampoon was like firing on all six cylinders. It was like you could talk about anything you wanted. There was absolutely nothing that was, you can't say that, Tony, or that's not funny, Tony.
But he had this extraordinarily educated Cambridge accent and was very literate and worldly, and yet behaved like a delinquent of 12 or 13.
The joys of wife tasting. Son O' God, according to Sean Kelly.
I was a humble Canadian school teacher. One day, my upstairs neighbor, Michel Triquette, came home and told me he was interested in starting to write for this National Lampoon magazine that was being started in New York. I thought, well, maybe I can come down to New York and become rich and famous and get tremendous amounts of drugs and sex and things, none of which panned out.
The Love Song of J. Edgar Hoover. The Quest for a Canadian Identity, a semicolon, the only feature on a face.
Sean Kelly actually fixed me up on a blind date with Michel Triquette. And then Michel started taking me to New York with him because I was, quote unquote, helping him with his work. I got into comedy the same way that Catherine the Great got into politics, on my back.
A cartoon shows a naked couple making out. In another, a cat hands a mouse a stick of dynamite. The mouse sticks it up the cat's butt.
I was working in a saloon on the west side. One night, somebody came over to me. There's a fellow back there stealing the ketchup. And I go after him. And I said, excuse me, I know what you're doing. And then I realized I'm standing here accusing somebody of stealing ketchup from a red rubber bottle. Some of this is so sad.
Very shortly thereafter, Henry offered me a job, and I gleefully took it.
Doug and Henry had this idea about bringing in this very hippie-ish art studio called Cloud.
Cloud Studios was an independent design firm. That's a generous term to use for those guys.
We were quote-unquote hippie artists because we weren't out to be millionaires. We were out to do the things we like to do. You know, we were turned on. And I don't mean by drugs, I mean by the ideas.
Doug liked to hang with people like Cloud Studio artists. He liked the fact that they were kind of freaky and wore costumes and had beards.
Doug would come to parties that we had, and when Doug wasn't in the office working, he was probably high as a kite.
Doug wanted to be a beat or a hippie. Doug wanted to be trendy and with it. I remember Doug asking, should I be for the Black Panthers? And he wasn't kidding.
Gangsters on a poster for the Concrete Jungle book find a baby on a pool table.
I saw the first issue, which was terrible.
They had this duck, and they were going to keep the duck as a logo on the cover, like the Playboy bunny. I said to Henry, get rid of the duck. That's not the Playboy bunny where, you know, you can put it on a garter, make it a pasty or whatever.
Everything they did was, it had to be funny looking, which means it was all sort of squirrely and hippie-like.
The issues were messy. They were confusing. It wasn't bringing in the readers, and they weren't getting the sales on the newsstand.
I told them, we've got to replace your art director. Doug was very upset. He wanted to keep Cloud, and he argued with me, but it was my call. I was the boss.
After we did the first 7 issues, I got a call from Doug Kenny. He said, I'm sorry, but you're no longer the art director.
Great. Knock yourself out.
A squeezed-out duck face down over the headline, down in the dumps. Then an ad, we're looking for people who like to laugh.
When I brought Michael Gross in, Doug was kind of hostile.
My first issue when I walked in the door was the nostalgia issue, which was Doug Kenny's baby. I knew when I was hired against Doug's will. In the sales pitch that I made, I referred to an article they'd done about postage stamps. I said, for these stamps to work, they should look like real stamps. You should be fooled when you look at them. Therefore, the parody is empowered.
And in that little example, he transformed the magazine.
After that, Doug came into my office and said, you were right about this guy.
As soon as Michael came aboard, the Lampoon began to look great.
A parody of Snoopy lying on his kennel with the line, death is. Playing Superman in a tree. Linus is hanged by his blanket. A white man and a man of color back to back eat bananas, one much bigger than the other.
And what the Lampoon began to be able to do was to create anything in any format so that it looked like the original.
Welfare Monopoly moves from Lenox Avenue to 125th Street via drug habit. A parody of The New Yorker shows a Rolls-Royce parked on an empty city street.
You know, Ed Sullivan, we kid him a lot, but Ed Sullivan is one of the greats of this business. And I had a funny thought. What if Ed Sullivan were tortured? And when I say tortured, what I mean is, what if steel needles, say 6 inches long, were plunged into Ed's eyes? I think it would go something like this.
You could walk into the Lampoon editorial office and get high just walking in. But as long as it stayed in the editorial office and as long as they were doing the terrific work they were doing, I didn't tell them what to do.
In the course of a given day, it was understood that the day didn't end when the office day ended.
They would have these dinner meetings in, like, some of the worst restaurants in New York.
There was a saloon called the Green Man. It was hot. It smelled of cat stink.
And they would sit around the table and drink tons and tons of beer.
This would be paid for by Henry or Doug. They would whip out their company, American Express card, and pay for dinner.
That's when we made up the next issue.
You had to either get Doug or Henry to react positively to your idea.
The ideas would come out very rapid fire. How did he think of that? And then how did he think of that? And how did he think of that?
We all do it the same way. You get drunk, you go home, you get up in the morning, and you write the piece.
Doug was who you went to really see if you had some wild and wacky, brilliant, but funny idea. Would Doug go, I got you, you're in.
I mean, he was a workaholic. I mean, he was unbelievably productive. Like, he wrote the letters column every month. I mean, it's like 2,200 very funny words of letters in like an hour and a half. I mean, every single time there was something that had to be done, he really was focused on it.
Doug was valuable in that sense because he would stimulate your ideas. I don't think that there really was anyone else who could inspire other people like Doug.
People would come to Henry with ideas and Henry would say, tempting, tempting.
Whatever idea you pitched him, he would say, tempting, tempting.
Tempting meant that that is so awful it really blows chunks, or I'm about to have an intellectual orgasm, it's so good.
Somehow Henry Beard would take this ragtag bunch of material and different types of personalities and brilliantly merge it together to make a magazine that was surprisingly coherent.
A series of covers, What Is Wrong With This Picture? A photo of a woman's butt, a lantern dangling between her legs. Most are cartoon style, commie plot comics, telling a kid his parents are dead.
It was like we had an attic full of culture that had been accumulating from 1945 to 1970. And we'd opened the trapdoor and nobody had been up there. And we just basically looted it.
Michael O'Donohue's Vietnamese Baby Book was an extraordinary piece of satire.
It was a baby book, but it was designed to be for a Vietnamese baby, and so it had things in it like baby's first wound.
It was incredibly dark, extremely political, and it was funny.
Michel Choquette came to me with an idea. He had run into a guy who looked just like Adolf Hitler.
The piece was called Stranger in Paradise, which was about Adolf Hitler really survived World War II and was living on a tropical island somewhere in the Caribbean.
I gave him a budget, and 10 days later, I got a telegram. He said, Hitler eating too much, need more money. I said, stop feeding Hitler and return to New York immediately. It was a brilliant article, which we resold to almost every foreign country.
Doug Kenny came up with the photo funnies concept. Doug insisted that they be us, some girls we brought in. I was so opposed. Guys, we're a real magazine. We don't need to take Polaroids in the fucking office. I was so wrong, because what Doug recognized is the audience identified with us. They went, these are like a bunch of jerk-offs like me. Like you and me, Bernie, look. That's Doug Kenny's genius.
They did probably one of the greatest magazine covers ever done.
Ed Bluestone came into the office and he said, you're gonna get a dog, I'm gonna put a pistol on his head, and you're gonna say, if you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog. I said, Ed, it's the most brilliant thing I've ever heard.
It was a huge, huge hit, because it's what every magazine publisher wanted to do. All they want to say is, buy the fucking magazine.
Boy Scouts round a campfire holding wieners, sometimes another, sometimes their own.
We realized that artists, well-known, established artists, people like Arnold Roth, the great cartoonist Gayon Wilson, Sam Gross, Charlotte Rodriguez is just a wonderful illustrator, Neil Adams. They all had to have drawers full of wonderful stuff that had been rejected by more traditional publications that weren't rejected because they weren't funny or good. They were rejected because they were a little too raunchy. So we knew we were that outlet.
It didn't matter how strange your work was. It didn't matter if your work was anti-Republican, anti-Democrat, anti the universe, whatever it was, you could bring it into them and they would not touch it.
And that's the great thing about the Lampoon. Never before, never since, had that kind of freedom.
If you were smart and funny, you walked into Henry Beard's office or Doug Kenny's office. Hello, can I come show you some stuff? And he goes like this, he goes, brilliant, thank you, you're hired. We don't pay much, but we're not gonna edit you. We're not gonna change you. We're gonna let you be what you wanna be.
An old lady dunks a teabag, her friend dunks a tampon.
We had one problem. Was losing a lot of money because we couldn't get advertising.
They sold little teeny mail order ads. They needed a pro to come in, make it bigger and more legitimate.
Jerry Taylor was an extraordinarily successful and sort of charismatic ad guy.
We had a difficult time getting appointments with advertising prospects.
It was always hard to be taken seriously. So I had a dress code, three-piece suit, white shirt, vest, tie.
We walked in looking exactly like the guys from Time Inc.
But still, nothing, zero, nothing mattered.
It was almost like they would vomit up this hostility on the desk. And I would just say, okay, that's cool. You don't have to buy a subscription, but now let me tell you why I think our audience is a great target for your product. Our readership drank more than the average adult. And the first liquor advertiser that we got into the magazine was Jose Cuervo. And it made other people, oh, wow, they've got a liquor advertiser in the Lampoon. And then the snowball started.
Ads for cigarettes, stereos, reel-to-reel tape recorders, and Alka-Seltzer.
Slogan, National Lampoon, there's nothing funny about the way it sounds.
In the same style, the National Lampoon Guide to Effective Salesmanship, an archive interview with Marshall McLuhan.
Tell me about National Lampoon. Why do you think it's so popular?
Well, I think they're very witty. Yes, they're very witty. But they are designed to please and flatter a particular audience of fairly well-to-do nobodies. Who can afford to be nobodies?
Gerald Ford splats an ice cream on his forehead. The Statue of Liberty smokes a joint. The 16 amazing differences between Lincoln and Kennedy. I survived the attack of the crazed Kent Kamikaze kids.
I honestly think that the National Lampoon is the most entertaining magazine I've ever read.
It's often the only magazine that a lot of younger pep people today read. And why that is I think they trust us. It looks really good. It's funny to look at. It's weird to look at. If you read the printed stuff, if you look at things that aren't the pictures, occasionally you find something really good, which you don't find anywhere else in the written humor form.
There was a lot of bad stuff going on. We'd just come out of the 60s. We had the assassinations, Vietnam. Now we had Watergate. So it was a perfect storm moment of brilliant comic sensibilities hitting the culture in a crisis point.
It was actually the first time that I realized that through humor, you can tell the truth. Brothers
and
sisters,
I have been in a mass media way, this kind of comedy didn't exist before then. People weren't that frank and didn't attack the establishment comedically.
We're basically a humor magazine and we publish things that we consider to be funny. It's just impossible to put out this kind of a publication and be completely unwilling to do something offensive.
I think it's sometimes conscious and sometimes just instinctive that we push things as far as they possibly can be pushed.
I've always had a bad attitude.
Always.
I'm earning a living off a bad attitude right now. Teachers always said it'd get me in trouble, but it's great. It's working for me. Yes, I've got
to know, yeah. Yes, in those days, magazines were a bigger deal.
People very much defined themselves by the magazines they read.
It was the most popular magazine on college campus in America and was the second most popular magazine on newsstands in America, second only to Cosmopolitan.
Biggest circulation we ever had was 1 million.
We had a pass along of maybe 12 or 15. So we probably had 12 million readers. I mean, it was huge.
It's our unerring charm that makes a reader swallow it month after month. And frankly, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Suddenly, Doug Kenny disappeared.
When Doug left or disappeared, it was a crisis.
One Sunday morning, I came downstairs and there was a note in the kitchen and it said, "Henry, I'm gonzo. I'm out of here. I'm gone. I'm finished. I'm done." And he was gone.
A radio tuner glows green.
And now the final question for $25,000. Name four famous Mickeys.
Mickey Mouse.
That's number one.
Mickey Mantle.
Number two.
Mickey Rooney.
That's number three. Only one more, you win $25,000.
Mickey Way.
Mickey Way?
The candy bar, they'll take that, won't they? The judges take that.
Because I had had a previous career as half of a comedy team, I had experience in how to write and put together an album. And I was paired with O'Donoghue, who wanted to do this album. So that's how Radio Dinner came to be.
But the album itself was very much Michael O'Donoghue. So Michael would say, "TV Dinner, what about Radio Dinner?" And then he'd go, "Yes," he'd write down Radio Dinner. And a year later, when someone said, "Let's do an album," he'd go, "Let's call it Radio Dinner."
Still one of my favorites was a parody song that Michael O'Donoghue and I wrote and that Tony Hendra ended up performing brilliantly, I might add.
"I resent the longing for your pokers, tell me what do you know? A lot of faggot middle-class kids wearing long hair and trendy clothes. I don't owe your pokers anything and all I got to say is fuck you."
It was right after John Lennon had an interview in Rolling Stone, and we had the idea that if you just put an occasional rhyme,
"The sky is blue,"
you could set the whole interview to music.
"George said she gave up evil vibes. I should have beat the fucking shit right out of him. Him with his fucking Hare Krishna."
The album was actually a great success. It got a tremendous amount of airplay. It was also nominated for a Grammy, which was pretty good first time out. It showed that we could do more than simply put out a magazine.
The truth is, Doug carried the magazine. If I wrote 100 words, he wrote 1,000 every month.
People hadn't really expected that he would disappear, but Doug was not a stable person.
He had an older brother who was the preferred son or the favorite son, and his older brother died at an early age, and it was a great loss to his parents, and his parents kind of treated Doug as I guess that's all we've got left. It probably did have some emotional impact on him.
And basically what happened is he had a nervous breakdown and just couldn't take it anymore.
He needed a break. He was having a sort of a midlife crisis at the age of 24, whatever. He was trying to figure himself out, and he picked up and moved to Martha's Vineyard.
I think he wanted to try something else. Before 30, he's got to do something new.
He wanted to write teenage commies from outer space. I went up to Martha's Vineyard to actually see Doug. My idea was to take stuff and develop from the magazine and put it on stage. And Matt, he said, didn't need Doug's touch. He looked completely wasted. He'd obviously been dropping acid and eating very little. He wanted to go for a walk because he had something to show me. And we walked out to where there's this peculiar kind of mud which runs right down to the sea. And he said it was really groovy in the summer to slather yourself with this stuff and just lie in the sun. So I pitched my idea and he said, "No, man, I can't do that. I'm too deep into my novel." And it turned out he'd written 1.5 chapters. The first album did so well, we've got to do another album. Wouldn't it be fun to parody Woodstock?
We're going to do a 3-night show, record it, edit it, and that would be the second album. But it got out of hand.
An album cover, Lemmings Dead in Concert.
We needed a cast of people who could be very funny and could play an instrument or at the very least, sing extremely well.
Tony Hendry called me one night. He said, there's a guy here at Second City in Chicago, and he's the funniest actor I've ever seen in my life. He's incredible. So I said, bring him to New York.
John Belushi.
Have your attention, please.
The theme of Lemmy's Woodchuck Festival was that everyone's come together to off themselves. That lemmings are animals that commit suicide by going over cliffs. So they were given advice on how they might do this along the way by the announcer, who was John
Belushi.
Now we all know why we came here. A million of us. We came here to off ourselves.
He made the character into this kind of manically agreeable, murderous lunatic.
Now, if your buddy's too stoned off himself, do him a favor. Roll him up in his sleeping bag and drag him over to where the tractors can run him down.
Chris Guest did a James Taylor that was genius.
Farewell, New York City, with your streets that flash like strobes. Farewell, Carolina, where I left my frontal lobes.
Hey!
There was a sketch where John and I were two high school or college guys at urinals just talking. I can't even remember what it was about. But I do remember that they were laughing all through. And it became clearer and clearer to me that they were laughing at John, whether we were saying anything or not. I'm like this, talking.
He mimes holding a small penis.
And finally, after like a week, I have to look over at him to see what the hell's going on, why they're always laughing. And he's like this.
Mimes holding a much bigger penis.
Never knew it, never told me. The little bastard just took me. It was so good.
It was decided, because the ticket sales were so brisk, that we would simply leave the show open. And at that point, from a record project, it actually became an off-Broadway show.
It was in this little tiny club in the Village, but it was an underground hit. It was a cool thing to go see.
Well, I'm standing here.
When we were with the actors, it got more rambunctious, because that was when actual uppers and downers and nose candy and things entered.
What about the acid? Did you get off on the acid? What acid? What do you mean, what acid, John? What acid? The LSD-25, man.
You mean the LSD-0.
Tony would go to Maddie and say he needed X bucks to buy marijuana for the cast. And then Tony, of course, would immediately buy cocaine with it. I mean, everybody can buy their own marijuana.
John collapses on stage, struggles to get up, rolls onto his belly, arched like a banana. He rocks and rolls over. Drags himself up by the microphone stand.
Henry Beard's office door hardly ever opened. Henry Beard sat there and typed. Pull them out. Pull out pages, pages, pages. Genius, brilliant, intellectual, and otherwise, pages. That's it.
Suddenly, I was working 100 hours a week. You know, I would go home and go to bed, and then wake up the next morning and go to the office and start writing again.
Henry really had become the leader of the magazine. When Doug was still there, it was a partnership. And when he left, Henry was the only person who could actually sort of be the final authority. And he had done that very, I think, grudgingly. So when Doug sidled back into the office, sort of saying, "Hi, I'm back," no one had much patience for Doug.
He came back humbled, deeply humbled, deeply, sadly humbled, tail between his legs. He knew what he'd done.
Doug brought the novel back, and Henry looks at it and goes, Jesus, this is awful.
I read this thing. It just made no sense. It was a complete nothing.
And what he did was he opened up the window on Madison Avenue and just scaled the whole thing out.
There were people not talking to him, and people were like doing this. They don't even want to see him. I was pissed at Doug, and I said, Doug, you know, you fucking let me down. You let us all down.
A photo of Doug holding a teddy bear on a rubbish tip titled Little Doug Kennedy Will Go to Bed Hungry Tonight. A radio tuner glows.
This is Julius.
And Ethel. Rosenberg.
Did you know that the majority of dead people are Jews? Mm-hmm. 85% of all dead people are Jewish. So remember, if you persecute Jews when you're alive, boy, are you going to get it when you're dead.
Doug had just gotten back from being AWOL for about a year, and I'd just been hired. And Michael O'Donohue, in the early Lampoon, wrote a brief parody of a high school yearbook. Maddie Simmons had the idea of turning this into a special edition, of doing a yearbook. Maddie gave us the job because basically we couldn't say no. Doug was still in the doghouse, and I was a fresh hire.
They weren't hot about the idea, but I wanted to do it, and I pushed them.
We're sitting around bemoaning our fate. This is such a stupid idea. How are we going to talk them out of this? And we just started talking about high school. And we started talking about how really there are only a dozen people in high school. Well, there's the beautiful frigid girl. There's the stupid jock. There's the exchange student from Absurdistan. You know, there's only a dozen, 18 people in high school. Bingo.
Up in the morning and out to school.
This is how you do it. You cast these 18 characters, and you spin out a year of their life, and you can get a whole book out of this.
You study them hard, hoping to pass.
When I got to the Lampoon, Ann Beats and Emily Prager were the only two women writers, so I was desperate to work on anything. And so I said to Doug Kenny, I volunteer. I will do anything you want to help you. I walked with crutches. I had polio as a kid. He said, oh, well, you know, there's always a handicapped kid in every school. Can we borrow your crutches? And I went, well, not without me, you can't. And so he said, all right, well, will you be in it? And I was Ursula Waterski. I think PJ was the woman's gym teacher, and, you know, Brian McConaughey doing the optometrist club, and they're all sort of listening to the side. It was a wonderful experience. It was like producing an independent movie.
It was perfect for Doug because he had simultaneously been just a regular high school guy and Doug Kenny, super brain, watching from on high. And he wore his high school jacket all the time, Doug. That was his natural costume.
Doug used his own picture as the dead student that the yearbook was dedicated to.
It was a work of true satirical brilliance. There were 50 storylines woven through it in all the different sections of it. It was really a comic masterpiece.
Doug was the personality of National Lampoon. He understood people.
Maddie Simmons.
Michael O'Donohue in The Office was like a time bomb. You never knew when it was going to go off.
Michael O'Donohue seemed to be the world's angriest guy.
And he would scream and yell, and he would throw telephone books and the phone. He'd rip the phone out and throw it across the office, narrowly missing people.
He was prone to, when you're stuck, you turn around, you're going to get angry at somebody, and you hit the people closest to you, you start slapping them around.
Michael was like a bundle of dynamite. For some reason, we hit it off when I first came to the magazine and were friends for a while, as everybody was with Michael for a while.
Michael had gotten in a giant feud with Tony over the fact that Tony had slept with Michael's then-girlfriend, Amy.
Michael marched in my office and said, you've got to fire him. And he told me what happened. I said, Michael, the one thing I never wanted to do is get involved with the personal lives of the people who work here.
Maddie gave Michael the National Lampoon Radio Hour as a compensatory thing. You're like, okay, they have Lemmings, you can have the Radio Hour.
Who is it?
Tom the Baker here.
Oh, Tom, come on in.
You're not Tom the Baker.
Watch out, he's got a knife.
Who are you?
I'm Bob the Rapist.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Come on in. Have some coffee. Good to see
you. In the beginning of the radio hour, I guess it was envisioned that the editors would be the writers. Michael's just sort of written Lemmings off and everybody in it. One day, Chris Guest was supposed to come in and do a Peter O'Toole imitation, and he called at the last minute to cancel. And I said, John can do Peter O'Toole. And that's how everybody in Second City entered the radio hour.
Hi, I'm your host person, Gilda Radner, and I'm going to read you the people who contributed: John Belushi, Brian Doyle Murray, Bill Murray, Gilda Radner, Harold Ramis, Ed Savitsky.
Ramis.
What?
Ramis, not Ramis.
These guys were all Second City guys, and they learned a craft, which is writing sketches.
What's the point, coach?
The point is this, Schnabel. They're winners and losers. But some guys don't even get to finish the game.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
There's a big coach somewhere in the universe, and he's taking one of us out. Stefanski, you got leukoplakia.
Huh?
The doc says you might not last the season.
I suppose that one of us ought to say something, coach, and ask the defensive captain.
Wait, that's not all. Luciano has Huntington's chorea. Schaefer and Collins, you two have sickle cell anemia, highly advanced. Townsend, Carlson, and McNulty, spinal meningitis.
Okay, that's pretty good. You can go on to the next one.
For human nerds, the National Lampoon is like an obscure record label that first recorded Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton. And you sort of can trace extraordinary talent back to this one little record label.
But we do a fair amount of music on the radio show. We do often performed by us because we're so awful that we couldn't ever get professionals to sound as bad as we want the thing to sound.
I wish I was a Negro with lots of Negro soul, so I could stay true to my ethnic roots and still play rock and roll. If I was a funky Negro eating soul food barbecues, I wouldn't have to sing the middle-class liberal well-intentioned blues.
Bob, we get some reaction from people accusing us of being racist or anti-Semitic, or we even got complaints from the Nazis that we were anti-Nazi or something.
All of the editors, I think, to a certain degree, are unbelievable racists. You ask, are we anti-Pollock? Of course we're anti-Pollock. They're so dumb.
What about racism being dealt with in the way it is in Lampoon?
I suggest simply the hotter the issue, the more they cool it by hilarity.
Why does one laugh? Laughter is entirely a defense mechanism. Laughter is a defense against hostility, a replacement for hostility, a defense mechanism against guilt, embarrassment.
Michael did a thing about Kentucky Fried Chicken, except, of course, the colonel was serving Kentucky Fried Black people. And you think, well, that's beyond tasteless, except it's sort of true.
Really good humor is saying the thing which is true, which you would do anything to deny is true.
So I wouldn't say the Kentucky Fried joke was a racist joke. It was a joke against racism.
We had a very disgruntled sponsor who dropped us. But I remember the memo we got afterwards from Maddie. You can make fun of poor people. You can make fun of Indians. You can make fun of anything you want. But do not make fun of the Jews.
It is the job of a satirist, okay, to make people in power uncomfortable. Really uncomfortable. To the point where they go, this has to be stopped.
Well-intentioned blues.
A poster reads the Ku Klux. Can, with your help.
In the National Lampoon, what really gets people angry? What do they sue you about?
Probably the most famous suit we ever had was the Volkswagen suit. We had a picture of a Volkswagen. We said if Teddy Kennedy had driven a Volkswagen, he'd be president today, which is true. Of course, Teddy Kennedy would be president if he drove a car that floated.
Well, the first thing we did, and this was Maddie, he sent out a news release along with the ad nationwide saying that Volkswagen was suing us. It got picked up in every newspaper in America. They ran the ad and the issue sold out.
I let them get away with things that even shocked me.
An eyeball and an asshole.
One day, I got a call from a vice president of NBC. He said, we've been talking about doing a Saturday night satire show. Would you be interested? We had all sorts of things going on.
We had live shows on the road. We had the magazine. We had a book division. It was the biggest radio show in the country. It was on 600 stations. We were the humor empire in the United States. I said, I really appreciate it, but it's too demanding.
National Lampoon was just a magazine, you know. But suddenly it was records and actors and musicians.
There was an extraordinary change in the sense that the spotlight was suddenly being shared. Well, I remember Chevy coming to the office and John Belushi coming to the office, and those guys had an energy to them that was very exciting. And you felt that it must have been difficult for editors who'd been around for a long time to not be part of that group.
The more famous and the more popular we got, the more people's egos were doing this.
Michael and Tony were heading in their different directions. It was very difficult, especially because you couldn't work for both of them at the same time, or they would consider you a traitor and a Mordred.
We don't need this. This is supposed to be fun and happy, and we're getting paid to be as silly as we can.
We're talking about the smartest, most curious, free-spirited people. These were not cageable people.
And people started leaving the Lampoon.
O'Donoghue's girlfriend was Ann Beats.
Maddie had given Michael Simmons my desk, and I was furious. It had taken me all that many years to get a desk, and then suddenly I didn't have it anymore.
He called me up one morning, and he said, I got to talk to you. Ann Beats must have an office at the radio show. If you don't do this, I'm going to quit.
Maddie said, well, she doesn't like it, she can quit. And if you don't like it, you can quit. And Michael said, I quit.
And he quit.
And that was it. Michael left, never came back.
I've been with the magazine 4 or 5 years. And rock and roll is the best analogy. You know, it's a band that just started to go bad. So it was just time for me to move.
A sign reads, one thing led to another, and before we knew it, we were dead. The radio tuner glows.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
And how long has it been since your last confession, my son?
About 4 months, I guess, Father.
Uh-huh.
I fucked this girl. Excuse my French, Father. I went all the way with this girl.
Don't be embarrassed, my son. I've heard it all before. I've heard much, much worse than that.
You heard cunnilingus?
I hear that from second graders.
Wow. Wobbly warhead, you heard that? Slamming a warhead at her?
Years ago.
Low clearance clit, you heard that?
Dwarf cock.
Bosom burger.
Scrotum breath.
Albino beaver.
Iguana tits.
Madam ovary.
Slime slit.
Mashy nipple lick.
Bug nuts.
Cock nose.
Vagina.
Oriental crack.
Superdome pussy.
Afterbirth on toast, that's pizza.
Punk piss.
Hillbilly snatch.
Boob pus.
Your rhino clit?
Rhino clit? That's disgusting. That's terrible. Nice mouth. You kiss your mother with that mouth? You eat with that mouth? Garbage mouth.
Well, the Nat Lamp, as it is affectionately called by both its friends and enemies, has taken its anarchism off its pages and put it on the stage in review form. They are the cast of the new National Lampoon show, which opens this Friday at the new Palladium Cabaret at 120 West 51st Street.
I've given up a life of comfort and wealth. Surely you can send something. A dime, a dollar, a pair of socks, some 50 caliber tracer bullets, or whatever you can to...
The Seminese Liberation Army, that's the SLA NLA, 418 Tuchman Building, Los Angeles, California.
When I was reading the magazine, I was very impressed with the writing in it. So I looked up on the masthead and found Maddie Simmons' name and called him.
He had seen the National Lampoon show in Toronto.
Maddie decided to do another stage show using Bill Murray, Gilda Radner, Harold Ramis, and much of the same talent in the radio hour.
So I said to Ivan, why don't you come in and run it in New York?
And now, the National Lampoon Radio Hour Singles Bar of the Year. Your opportunity to meet some of today's most beautiful, bright, talented, sensitive, and unattached young men and women. Will that perfect mate be you?
Hiya, fella. Nice weather, isn't it? I used to believe in ethical culture, but then I switched to Zen. My hobbies are plants, and once I had an ant farm.
I showed up to one of the early rehearsals, and there's a kind of a discussion about some little thing that's going on. And I just naturally say, well, wouldn't it be better if you... I made some suggestions. Suddenly, the whole group stopped. And they looked at me, this outsider, and wondered, did he just say something? Did he have the nerve to actually open up his mouth and direct us? Bill Murray, always the bravest of the group, sort of walked up to me very calmly, put his arm around me and patted me on my back, got my winter scarf and wrapped it very slowly around my neck, and said, hey, thanks for dropping in. We'll see you. And he patted me and he ushered me out of the room. It was very, very embarrassing.
Better luck next time.
Rehearsal of warm-up. Cross take first to the right eyebrow. Ready. And one. And.
John raises and lowers one eyebrow.
And five, and six, now left, and two, and come on, up, down, and halt, and cross. And
Belushi was this sort of great performer. He was the center of the National Lampoon show. He basically acted as the director.
What are you doing here?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a congressman from Cleveland. I took kickbacks all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm stuck here in prison farm, doing 90 and 9
years.
No hours.
I'm a white collar criminal. My wife's a debutante.
Oh, yeah.
I'm stuck in prison farm for as long as I want.
What was really remarkable about John was that he was the rock and roll of humor. I mean, he represented those two things in perfect combination.
You know, we gotta eat caviar.
Yeah,
we
can.
We got a chauffeur in a car.
Oh, Lord.
We got a church and a school. We got a sauna and a pool. 6 months on prison farm.
He was very focused on the business side of it as well. He was the one who would call me up every week and say, hey, you're not advertising enough. Or, we should put these quotes on.
My honey told her to say my tennis
I think it was Sean who said to Maddie, put him on retainer. Give him $500 a week just to keep him here. And Maddie didn't do it.
Let us begin. Repeat after me. I would like to feed your fingertips.
To feed your fingertips.
To the Wolverines.
To the Wolverines.
Next. I am afraid. We are out.
We are out.
Badgers. Would you accept a Wolverine?
A Wolverine.
In its place.
In its place.
Next.
The teacher grabs his heart and keels over. The student raises an eyebrow, then does the same.
Most of the cast of Saturday Night Live was taken right from the first company of the National Lampoon show.
Starring the not-for-any primetime players.
The producer of Saturday Night Live watched our show for about a month and then hired the people.
You're
in
talking
the show.
About Lorne Michaels, who produces.
Yeah, I forgot his name. Lorne Michaels. No, I know his name.
Are you mad at him?
No, I'm not mad.
Of course.
Since he has most of my actors and many of my writers.
You could almost feel the energy sucked out of the magazine and into that show.
It was written by some Lampoon people. It was starring some former Lampoon people. And it was very glamorous and was a huge hit from the beginning. And I gathered pretty quickly that if I liked Saturday Night Live, I should keep it to myself.
Suddenly, what the Lampoon offered was available to a much larger audience. The Lampoon lost its exceptionalism.
John Belushi acts the rock star at the mic in front of a band.
What would you do if I sang how to? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Oh, baby, I'll get.
I've described the Lampoon as the hippest place to be to write comedy. And it was, until the hippest place to be to write comedy became Saturday Night Live. Chevy Chase came over to the Lampoon offices and he chuckled and he said, nobody gets laid writing for the National Lampoon anymore.
Peter Kleinman.
This friend of mine tells me that Michael Gross is leaving the Lampoon, the art director, and I should apply for the job. And I walk into the conference room, and Doug Kenny says to me, well, I have three questions. Can you get us drugs? Can you get us nude models? And do you have some place where we can go with the drugs and the nude models? And I thought very seriously, and I said, yes, yes, and yes. And Doug looked at me and he says, well, I have no further questions.
Peter had very little pretension in terms of art, as did Michael Gross.
Totally different kind of person, but he got it, you know, and that's the thing that mattered.
He was a great-looking guy who was not afraid to approach people of the opposite sex and suggest that they might get to know one another better, which was somewhat fascinating to all of us.
Every 30 days, we were putting out this 100-page magazine. Didn't matter how dirty or how vile or how perverted or how sexual or how twisted or violent it was. If it was funny and if Doug liked it, it was in.
A small Santa shins his way up a naked woman's thigh. She says, yes, vagina, there is a Santa Claus.
We knew all along that Doug and Henry Beard and Rob Hoffman would ask us to buy them out after 5 years.
However, the buyout said that they would buy it out at 21 times earnings, which was outrageous.
They stood to make a nice piece of change.
I owed them $7.5 million. So we met with them and we sat down and we talked.
For whatever reason, any reasonable alternative to the buyout was rejected. So when push came to shove, we showed.
I don't think Maddie was prepared. I don't think Maddie Simmons really thought Doug and Henry would go through with it. And they did.
Henry hinted a few times that, you know, this could be good for you guys, meaning Sean, Tony, and myself.
Other people apparently felt that they were stakeholders. And, you know, they weren't.
They all thought Henry had promised them a lot of money, and he walked out of that office the day the check was cashed. He stood up on a desk and said, I hated every minute of this. Fuck you. And left.
When Henry got up and told us that he was never going to talk to any of us again, it was such a shattering experience for all of us because he was the one we were trying to please.
I think the culture changed. And, you know, people grew up. You know, it had a lifespan.
The radio tuner glows.
Never send care packages to the so-called starving families in Europe because they're not starving at all. Can you afford to live in Europe? No. You can't even afford to visit Europe. And do you know what they do with the care packages you send? They whack them with their polo mallets and kick them into their swimming pools.
The first time I saw Doug after the buyout, I said, what are you going to do with all this bread? That's so great. And Doug said, I'm going to Disneyland.
Doug was going to quit.
He was wealthy now, and he was going to quit. And Maddie was smart enough to know that, holy shit, if I lose Doug, I'm going to lose the heart and soul of this company. And so he said, well, don't quit, Doug. We're going to make a movie. And Doug went, really?
Once I told Doug we were making a movie, we had to make a movie. Ivan then started coming up with ideas with Harold Ramis.
I knew that the high school yearbook was the most popular thing that the National Lampoon had ever put out. So I called up Doug Kenny and said, hey, why don't you help Harold write this high school movie? They started writing a screenplay that was Charlie Manson and his followers back when they were still in high school.
There was so much sex and drinking and what have you involved with it that I said, we can't do this in high school. We'll get lynched.
So I spoke to Maddie about shifting away from high school to college, and we were thinking of using Chris Miller's stories.
Chris Miller was the most popular short story writer in the history of the Lampoon.
He specialized in stories based on his Dartmouth years.
My stories were about college and getting loaded and living a wild life and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or the absence of those things.
Doug Kenny went crazy over it because they didn't do shit like that at Harvard.
Ramis, Kenny, and Miller worked for a full year on what became a 114-page treatment. It's the biggest treatment anyone's ever seen.
And so that really became Animal House.
After the buyout, we bumped along until PJ took the title of editor-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
I went to work as Matty's assistant, but I wound up as editor-in-chief because I had had some prior publishing experience. I actually knew what on time and under budget meant.
The era of PJ being the editor-in-chief, it was less highbrow and more approachable.
Editorial meetings were way different. Before he was editor, editorial meetings were hanging out and trying to one-up each other and consisted of this free flow of ideas. When PJ took over, he was the chair of every meeting. He had an agenda on his legal pad. He would read us things that he had written that he thought were particularly funny.
PJ was one of those people that really worked hard. It was not an endearing quality.
It needed a grown-up. But frankly, it stopped being fun. Let it all hang out.
How to talk your wife into oral sex. Beg, wheedle, plead, moan, groan, and whine. The object being to have her grab it in disgust and perform the dirty deed to shut you up. By John Hughes.
I was always an enormous fan of John Hughes. He did all of this humor about families and growing up, and then really funny, dirty stuff.
When I was running the magazine, he was the best person I had working for me. John could hew within sort of one degree of reality and make it hilarious.
On the surface, he was all American, almost like this nice family guy. And then you'd start reading his stuff, and it was the most sick, sexual, depraved, deviant stuff you've ever read.
P.J. O'Rourke and John Hughes and the kinds of articles they liked and wrote and edited were politically different and culturally and socially different than the stuff we had done, and the kinds of readers changed also.
I knew no one in Hollywood, but this is one of those things that has to happen. You have to have luck to go with talent. I got a phone call about a week later from a guy who said, Mr. Simmons, I'm the assistant to Ned Tannen at Universal Studios, and I just want you to know that I'm a huge Lampoon freak, and if you ever want to do a movie, please call me. We met with Ned Tannen, and he said, I hate this. Everybody's a drunkard, a womanizer, they're doing drugs. But he had two assistants, Sean Daniel and Tom Mount, who had always thought this project could work, and they were pushing it.
As a National Lampoon fan, I just thought, this is hilarious. Not everyone thought it was as funny as I did. In fact, it was held in total contempt.
My deal was that if any part of the National Lampoon show, which I produced, sort of led to what was going to be a National Lampoon movie, then I was going to have the opportunity to direct it. But the only film I had directed up to that point was Cannibal Girls.
They love every man they meet. First to death, then for dinner.
Universal said, well, you can produce it, but you can't direct it.
My girlfriend at the time was working as a script supervisor on Kentucky Fried Movie. She said to me, you have got to get to know the director of this movie, John Landis.
Sean approached me and said, would you be interested in making a film at Universal? It was like, duh. And he gave me this script, Animal House.
Ned Tannen took me in his office and said, look, a lot of people around here hate this and don't think we should be doing it. But you believe in it, go away, bring us back a movie.
You had to spend your whole life worrying about your mistakes. You fucked up. You trusted us.
I'd never done a comedy, and I just was so over where my career was, and it was like, I have to be in this movie.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
I auditioned for John Landis. He said, the guy, he's smarmy. He's a smarmy guy. Can you do that? I had no idea what the word smarmy meant, so I just kind of made this face. And he's like, that's great!
My kid can't see. Is it all right if he stands in front of you?
No, I couldn't sleep at all that night.
I really wanted the writers on set. Universal, of course, is a low-budget picture. Told me to go fuck myself. So what I did was I said, look, get yourself to Eugene, and I will hire you every day as actors. Chris and Doug being there was important. And Doug Kenny, really important, because, you know, we made up a lot of stuff shooting.
What the hell is supposed to do, you moron?
Doug was always the smartest guy in the room. you know, and the richest guy, and the one with the drugs. So it was a real special time because it was a chance to meet all these people that I had always revered, you know, the Lampoon, and that Doug had founded it and was as smart in person and funny in person as the magazine was.
I know that for Doug, he was in heaven. He had the time of his life. But Ned Tannen was very upset about it, very concerned. And really, we were in trouble for a while. When he saw the movie, he didn't like it and didn't find any of it funny.
Came time to preview the movie in front of an actual paying audience. The president of the corporation came, who had been one of the non-believers, and all the executives were there.
The time has come for someone to put his foot down. And that foot is me.
It was, you know, you're sitting there very nervous how they like the movie. They went nuts.
Suddenly the studio went, oh my God, this really worked.
And from that moment on, we went from being criminals, suspects, to heroes.
I remember seeing it with my mom. It was the first time I saw women's breasts in front of my mother. I literally can remember how many people were in the theater and what it looked like and my red, shamed face.
You know, you have to remember that Animal House created a genre.
The clock downstairs was striking two.
So we figured, wow, this is awesome. Everybody's going to love the magazine now and see that we're more mainstream because of this movie, which was a huge success. What we didn't anticipate was that Hollywood now would rear its voracious head and take away all of our wonderful creative talent.
The second it came out, somebody hired me to write about college kids drinking and having sex in cars, and everybody wanted to have a meeting, even if, and I had nothing to do with the movie. I just worked at the Lampoon for a while.
A dotted line on a map of the states populated by near-naked women tracks from New York to L.A.
Doug came out to Hollywood, and the search for joy and for ecstasy was a major fact of life. That was what we did.
I realized that this is what he wanted to do. I mean, Doug Kenny should be writing movies. He was a producer.
He seemed to be running the whole show. He was the engine that was making the wheel turn. You left me
sitting. Doug was just on an upward road to fame.
I remember going to Doug Kenny's house when I first came to Hollywood. They were having the most fun in town. They were what was going on in town.
There was that part of him that enjoyed being a star. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me.
Let it shine, 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 let it shine. Doug and Chevy had this great chemistry. They could start going and you just sit back and just watch the party.
He considered himself the most handsome man in comedy. He'd be in front of the mirror and say, look, most handsome man in comedy. And then I'd stand behind him and go, almost. I get a little lonely
in the middle of the night. Wherever Doug was, it would be a party. Just full of people, studio heads and guys from Denny's, you know, I mean, just anybody he met. And it would go on for hours, sometimes days. Baby, please, shut on the light, let it shine on me.
Shut on your love light, let it shine on me. A little bit higher, a little bit higher, just a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. Doug's career was really taking off. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, everyone was making disco beavers from outer space.
There was a giant beaver walking around throughout everything, eating the floors. So in the middle of a sketch, the floor would collapse and this beaver who had eaten it would pop up.
Do I really have to talk about disco beaver?
Somebody at the Lampoon called me and said, look, we have a whole bunch of kids coming in from Harvard. And we'd like you to come to the magazine and just kind of tutor these guys. I thought, okay, that sounds like fun.
My first week at the National Lampoon, we were getting drunk in a park with bagpipers there. I saw a fist fight. There was a man secretly living in his office. It was a crazy place, like nothing I'd ever seen before.
You know, for a guy just out of college, this was a dream. You know, you were able to actually write comedy for a living, which was astounding to me. One thing that Mike and I did early was these articles about how to write, and we did one that Thurgood Marshall, the Supreme Court Justice, did, How to Write Dirty, where he instructed you how to write pornography.
I had the thought that if Thurgood Marshall, he would never see this article, but if he did, I thought maybe he would even enjoy it, right?
He was so upset by that, he called the FBI and said, what can I do to them? And the FBI said, well, there's a thing called freedom of speech, Mr. Justice, that protects them.
Do what you like. After Animal House, Howell and Doug went up to Florida and made Caddyshack.
Caddyshack was not a Lampoon movie, but it was a Doug Kenny movie, and Doug Kenny was the Lampoon, so obviously it was a Lampoon movie. I mean, it may not have been officially a Lampoon movie, but with Chevy and Billy, Doug and Brian, I mean, it was a Lampoon movie. That was the spirit of the Lampoon.
Doug was the producer of Caddyshack, but it all seemed a little disorganized. There was a kind of haphazard quality to the way in which the film was created.
Stop thinking, let things happen, and be the ball. Denny?
Sure. It's only like my second movie or something. I don't remember. Everybody was smoking pot.
It's a little harsh.
It was a very nocturnal movie. Cocaine was just always there.
Cocaine wasn't bad for you. You do this and you go, I can't believe this isn't bad for me. You know, because it wasn't considered at that time to be a bad thing. For a while.
He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad, oh, he got all of that one.
I remember when Caddyshack came out, Newsday gave it 2.5 stars, and I'm like, what? This is like the best movie ever.
Caddyshack is not about the Mikado's daughter-in-law elect. It's about as rotten a movie as a slop the screen this summer.
Doug was very distraught and upset that Caddyshack wasn't as big as Animal House. I said, geez, you know, Animal House is a home run, so let's just say Caddyshack's a double or a triple. But who cares?
I was at Dangerfields with Billy and maybe Harold promoting the picture, and somebody came up to me after and he said, Doug is... And I could see that Doug was, like, asleep on a table back there. He was already loaded at noon or whatever.
I'd seen him depressed before, but this was like he had achieved a level of depression that was impressive to me, and I'm good at being depressed. And it was about the movie. He'd spent a year and a half of his life or something on this thing, and look, what I got is a talking gopher, for Christ's sake.
It actually did fine. It kind of hit the mark a lot of films do. It just wasn't his mark. So I guess that's probably part of what happened to Doug, just feeling it should have done better. He could have done better.
At that point, the magazine was on the skids in terms of its sales, and it was believed by management that the way to get it back to being its a bestseller was to have more tits.
Cartoon breasts and photos.
They had this mandate that every sixth issue or second issue or every issue had to be a sex issue.
Yeah. Are you ready?
And we couldn't afford B-list tits. We had like D and E-list tits. And the more tits and ass we put on the cover, the more 7-Elevens and everybody put it under the counter, so it didn't matter what was on the cover.
Then the phone rang, and they said, do you want to quit your job and come to Hollywood? And we said, yes, who is this?
The kids left to go write The Simpsons and every other thing that's huge. We were in something of a death spiral.
A headline reads how hip the National Lampoon used to be.
I was working on a movie called Club Sandwich. We had to have a meeting with our producers, and that was Michael Schamberg and Alan Greisman and Doug. And in comes Doug, and behind him comes this Coke dealer. And Doug says, "Be right with you guys." He lays a rail of this Coke along his arm, and he goes, and the entire amount of cocaine goes up his nose. And he says, "Okay, we're having a meeting now." And I had been as big a drug abuser as anybody, and I had hung around with Doug a lot. I had never seen Doug do something like that at 9 a.m. when a business meeting was about to be held.
In Hollywood, it's one of those things. They don't care what you do. Just as long as you show up to work and you're okay, then whatever you do in your own time, that's what you do on your own time.
Hello. This is a recorded message from your suicide prevention phone. Now, first of all, why not stop, take a deep breath, and think for a minute. Can things really be all that bad? Sure, the road of life can be pretty bumpy sometimes, but isn't that just part and parcel of that rich tapestry we call living? You know, a wise man once said, today is the first day of the rest of your life.
Photos of Doug staring at a slide rule.
I mean, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I guess Doug was an addict. You know, he had the disease of addiction, right? Doug couldn't not be high.
Coming out to L.A. was very bad for Doug. I think the cocaine out here was everywhere. And Doug just went for it as hard as anybody has ever gone for it.
Doug wasn't as happy as I thought I might be if I had, you know, that kind of success and that kind of notoriety and money. It was sort of an emptiness, there was a sadness.
He was having trouble. And they said, you know, take him away or for a week or something. So Doug and I went off together. I took him to Hawaii.
I think that he and Chevy were at that time battling their attraction to drugs.
I remember one point we were at the hotel on Maui, like at the 15th floor. I went to his room and told him I couldn't take it anymore. I was so depressed. And I went back to my room and I took my boots off and left them right by the fence, the terrace, and then the sound of somebody falling from the terrace or jumping. And he came running, and of course I'm hiding. And for a second, he really actually looked. Oh. I'm telling you all this about Doug because I miss him very much. He was my best friend. I had to come back to work finally, back to California. I left him in Hawaii.
I got a call from Doug's girlfriend, and he was missing, and did I know where he was? And I had no idea.
One day I was talking to him, the next day he was missing.
Doug being missing wasn't that unusual, but this time it didn't feel right.
I flew back out, and we found Doug, but he was at the bottom of what they called the Grand Canyon in Kauai.
A cartoon of a pink Cadillac parked at the edge of a precipice. A black and white photo of Doug captioned, "Doug Kenny, one of the founders of National Lampoon, died in a hiking accident on the island of Kauai on August 29th, 1980.
I don't want to suggest for a minute that what happened to Doug was expected, and it was awful when I got the news, but it was not entirely incompatible with the life he'd been living.
It was a tragic loss. He was the first person I knew that I considered a drug casualty.
Was he stoned and fell off the cliff? Was he suicidal and jumped off the cliff? Or was he in fact murdered in a drug deal, which is what a lot of people think?
They said that there was a sign, the cliff where he died, that said, do not go beyond this point. And as soon as I heard that, I just saw Doug read it and say, you mean here?
He wrote me a chatty letter from Hawaii and told me look forward to seeing me when he came to L.A. He wanted to talk about something. So I don't think he killed himself.
He was never a guy to take his life. And having thought of it, about it all this time over the years, I think that he slipped, which is stupid. And it killed him, so I was that.
I've heard every version of this, and I have no idea.
Chris Miller very brilliantly said, Doug was looking for a better place to jump from when he slipped.
Doug's pictured on the cover of the magazine waving a saw, carrying away the missing arms of the statue of Venus de Milo. The screen goes black.
Had he lived, Doug Kenny would have been kind of force in American movie making, directorial force that John Hughes was, the kind of movies he made.
Wally World!
John Hughes wrote the short story, Vacation 58. I called him in, I said, John, I'm gonna make a movie of this.
I think you're all fucked in the head. We're 10 hours from the fucking fun park and you wanna bail out.
Vacation was my family, I went on those trips and it was that heinous, you know, every single time.
We're all gonna have so much fucking fun, we'll need plastic surgery to remove our goddamn smiles. You'll be whistling Zippity Doodah out of your assholes.
It was rated R. Dogs are being killed. Adultery is being flaunted. There's elderly abuse, incest, masturbation, kidnapping. It's a lot of stuff that you wouldn't think of as being present in what has become like a beloved family film.
Good talk, son.
Talk, Dad.
I think Maddie said something like, well, this is National Lampoon.
If there was a golden age and a silver age and a platinum age, this would probably be the moldy rye bread age of the National Lampoon. We were doing this horror and fantasy issue, and we were trying to come up with the most horrible, gruesome, funny ideas. And I said, what about a baby in a blender? And everybody like, that's so funny, baby in a blender.
It was supposed to be a satire of a famous old saying, something that went something like, it's a worse mess than a baby in a blender.
So we decided we would do it. And I took a picture of a baby crying and took a picture of a blender. And we actually stripped them together so it looked like the baby was in the blender. And we put Satan's finger on the puree button.
There was a group called the Christian Coalition which hated us because we made fun of groups like the Christian Coalition. They organized a group of right-wing zealots and they sent letters around and we lost almost all our national advertising.
It went downhill from there, and I'm going to end it on that note.
A quote from William Randolph Hearst, give me a magazine cover with a beautiful girl, a dog, or a baby on it, and I'll give you a magazine that sells. On the cover of a magazine depicting a beautiful girl serving a dog with an apple in its mouth to a baby.
Still don't know what I was waiting for.
The things that happen to us when we're young just seem so much more important than other things because they're happening for the first time.
You know, looking backwards is always a dangerous position. You could really throw your neck out. But when I do look back at all of this, I feel lucky.
The National Lampoon really changed my life. It introduced me to this extraordinary group of performers that were really the finest comedic actors of their generation.
Some people might think this is an egregious comparison, but I would say that my years at the Lampoon were not unlike the Paris of the 20s that Hemingway describes in A Movable Feast. Wherever two or more Lampoon people got together in those years, something explosive happened. Change me, but
I can't trace. I felt like I snuck in some magical clubhouse. With those people there, you knew you were never going to see people like that again.
And these children. At the end of the year, when I'm talking to students who are about to graduate, I say, I wish them that they get maybe 5 years in their whole working lives like the 5 years I got, where you're doing stuff that, frankly, you would pay to do, except you're getting paid to do it.
It's a time of dial telephone. There's no internet. There's no computers. There wasn't that much that was shared, but what was shared by everybody. They absolutely had everything in common. And it's in a way that never will happen again.
I'm just so super proud of that period of my life, not to mention blessed. I somehow was part of the greatest band of an era.
Really what is important, I think, is just those people. They became all of modern comedy.
Over a photo of the team, the title, Drunk, Stone, Brilliant, Dead, National Lampoon.
Doug always had a predilection for sticking his dick in girls' ears. It was something that he would surprise everybody by doing in the middle of a cocktail party or something. There would be Doug with his dick in some girl's ear. And he used to say to me, Chris, I hope that somehow I'll go to heaven and I'll be able to stick my dick in the ear of Eleanor Roosevelt. And so when Doug died, I figured he definitely got into heaven, and probably even right now, he's sticking his dick in the ear of Eleanor Roosevelt.
A Douglas Tirola film. Cinematography, Sean Price Williams. Archival footage courtesy of CBC TV Archive. Sales, Film Archives Incorporated. NBC Universal Archives, Ketsy 9 Animal House Footage, Chambers Communications Corporation. University of Oregon Libraries, Eugene, Oregon. Distribution Advisory Services, Synetic Media. Thank you to the Sundance Film Festival. Supported by TFI, A&E Indie Film Story Lab, Tribeca Film Institute. The soundtrack is available on Amazon. When in Greenwich Village, New York, visit Kettle of Fish. Copyright 2015. Cartoon Restaurant. On the menu, try our frog's legs. The kitchen door opens. A small frog wheels itself out on a trolley. The screen goes blank.
You've been listening to the National Lampoon Radio Hour.
Fourth Row Films.